Chapter 28. Cerberus Hades, Delta Pavonis Heliopause, 2566. She had lost control again. Volyova watched helplessly as the cache weapons opened fire on Cerberus. The beam weapons found their mark first, of course, and the first indication that returned was a spark of blue-white light, winking open against the arid grey backdrop of the world, in the precise spot where, shortly, the bridgehead would reach the surface. The relativistic projectile weapons were only slightly tardier, and reports of their success followed a few seconds later. Spectacular stuttering pulses as the projectiles rained home, slugs of neutronium and antimatter slamming into the world. All the while, she kept barking the disarming commands into the bracelet, but with steadily draining hope that she could have any influence over the weapons. For one foolish instant she had assumed that the replacement bracelet was faulty, but of course that could not be, why the weapons were now behaving autonomously. They had fired for a purpose, just as they had disregarded her order to return to the bowels of the ship, because someone, or something, now had control.
"What's happening?" Pascal asked, in the tones of someone who did not honestly expect a comprehensible answer.
"It must be Sunstealer," Volyova said,
finally giving up on the bracelet, relinquishing all hope of the weapons returning to her steerage.
"Because it can't possibly be Curie's Mademoiselle. Even if she were still capable of influencing the cache, she'd be doing everything in her power to prevent this.
Part of him must have stayed behind in the gunnery," Curie said.
She seemed to regret that, because she went quiet very abruptly, before adding,
"I mean, we always knew he could control the gunnery. That was why he resisted the Mademoiselle when she wanted to kill Sylvestre with the other weapon. But with this precision?"
Volyova shook her head.
"Not all my commands to the cache weapons are routed through the gunnery. I knew that was too big a risk to take.
And you're saying even those aren't working?"
"So it would appear."
The display now showed that the weapons had ceased their attack, depleted of energy and munitions, drifting into useless orbits around Hades, where they would remain for millions of years, until swept by random gravitational perturbations into trajectories which would smash them into Cerberus, or fling them out towards the Trojan points, where they would endure even the red giant death of Delta Pavonis. Volyova extracted a residual grain of comfort in knowing that the weapons could not be used again, could not be turned against her, but it was far too late for such succor. The damage against Cerberus had already been done, and there would now be very little to hinder the bridgehead when it arrived. She could already see the evidence of their attack displayed on the display, plumes of pulverized regolith fanning into space around the impact point. Sylvestre arrived at the ship's medical center, Sajaki increasingly heavy against his shoulders. The man seemed to weigh far too much for his lean frame. Sylvestre wondered if it was because of the sheer mass of machines streaming through his blood. Waiting dormant in every cell, biding their time until a crisis such as this stirred them to life. Sajaki was hot, too. Feverishly so. Perhaps evidence that the Medicines had gone into an emergency breeding frenzy, building up their forces to deal with the situation, conscripting molecules from the man's normal tissue until the hazard was averted. When Sylvestre glanced reluctantly at the Triumvir's ruined wrist, he saw that the blood had stopped flowing, and the dreadful circumferential wound was now enveloped in a membranous caul. A faint amber luminosity shone through the tissue. Servitors emerged from the center as he approached, taking the burden from him, lofting Sajaki to a couch. The machines fussed over him for a few minutes, swan-like monitors angling over the bed. Various neural monitors settled gently over his scalp. They did not seem overly concerned by the wound. Perhaps the medical systems were already communicating with his medicines, and there was no need for further intervention at this stage. He was still conscious, Sylvestre observed, despite his weakness.
"You should never have trusted Volyova," he said angrily. "Now everything's ruined because she had too much power. That was a fatal mistake, Sajaki."
His voice was barely there.
"Of course we trusted her. She was one of us, you fool, part of the Triumvirate."
Then he added in a croak,
"What is it you know about Curie?"
"She was an infiltrator," Sylvestre said, "put aboard this ship to find me and kill me."
Sajaki reacted to this as if it were only mildly diverting.
That's all?
That's all I believed. I don't know who sent her or why, but she had some absurd justification, which Valyova and my wife seem to have taken as the literal truth.
It isn't over yet,
Sajaki said, his eyes wide, rimmed in yellow.
What do you mean, it isn't over?
I just know,
Sajaki said, and then closed his eyes, relaxing back into the couch.
Nothing is finished.
He's going to survive, Sylvester said, entering the bridge, obviously unaware of what had just taken place. He looked around him, and Valyova could imagine his confusion. Superficially, nothing had changed in the time it had taken him to escort Sajaki to the infirmary. The same people holding the same guns. But the mood had undergone a dire transition. Hegazi, for instance, despite being on the wrong end of Kuri's needler, did not wear the expression of a man on the defeated side. Neither, however, did he look particularly jubilant. It's out of all our hands now, Valyova thought, and Hegazi knows it.
Something went wrong, didn't it?
Sylvester said, who had by then taken in the view of Cerberus on the display, with its ruptured crust bleeding into space.
Your weapons actually opened fire, just as we wanted.
Sorry, Valyova said, shaking her head. It was none of my doing.
You'd better listen to her, Pascal said. Whatever's going on here, we don't want any part of it. It's bigger than us, then, bigger than you, anyway, hard as that may be to believe.
He looked scornful. Haven't you realized yet? This is exactly how Valyova wanted it to happen.
You're mad, Valyova said.
Now you get your chance, Sylvester said. You get to see your planet penetrator in action, while at the same time salving your conscience with this conveniently unsuccessful display of 11th-hour caution.
He clapped his hands twice.
No, honestly, I'm genuinely impressed.
You'll be genuinely dead, Valyova said.
But while she hated him for saying what he had said, there was part of her which refused easy denial. She would have done anything in her power to stop the weapons from completing their mission. Hell, she had done everything in her power, and none of it had worked. Even if she had not given the order to release them from the ship, Sunstealer would surely have found a way. She was sure of that. But now that the attack had taken place, a kind of fatalistic curiosity had settled over her. The bridgehead's arrival would proceed as planned, unless she could find a way of stopping it, and thus far she had tried everything she knew. And therefore, because there was no way of preventing it from happening, a detached part of her was beginning to look forward to the event, tantalized not just by what would be learned, but how well her child would endure its trials. Whatever happened, she knew, no matter how fearful the consequences might be, it could not help but be the most fascinating thing she had ever witnessed, and perhaps the most terrible. There was nothing to do now except wait. The hours passed neither swiftly nor slowly, because this was an event she was dreading as much as longing for. 1,000 kilometers above Cerberus, the bridgehead commenced its final braking phase. The brilliance of the two conjoiner drives was like a pair of miniature suns flaring into ignition above Cerberus, shocking the landscape into stark clarity, craters and ravines assuming enormously exaggerated prominence. For a moment, under that merciless glare, the world really did look artifactual, as if its makers had striven too hard to make Cerberus look weathered by eons of bombardment. On her bracelet now she was seeing images recorded from the down-looking cameras studded around the bridgehead's flanks. There were rings of cameras every 100 meters along the length of the 4-kilometer cone, so that, no matter how deeply it penetrated, some cameras would always be above and below the crustal layer. She was looking through that crust now, through the still unhealed wound which had been opened by the cache. Sylvester had not been lying. There were things down there, huge and organic and tubular, like a nest of snakes. The heat of the cache attack had dissipated now, and although greyish clouds were still smoking from the hole, Valyova suspected they were more to do with incinerated machinery than boiled crustal matter. None of the snake-like tubes were moving, and their segmented silvery sides were marked by black smears and 100-meter-wide gashes, through which a whole intestinal mass of smaller snakes had exploded. Volyova had hurt Cerberus. She did not know if it was a mortal wound, or just a graze which would heal in days, but she had hurt it, and the realization of that made her shiver. She had hurt something alien. Soon, however, the alien thing retaliated. She jumped when it happened, even though, intellectually, if not emotionally, she had been expecting it. It happened when the bridgehead was 2 kilometers from the surface, half its own length away. The event itself was almost too swift to absorb. Between one moment and the next, the crust changed with startling swiftness. A series of gray dimples had formed, ringed concentrically around the kilometer-wide wound, blistering like stone pustules. Almost as soon as Volyova noticed their existence, they ruptured, unleashing twinkling spore, silver glints which swarmed towards the bridgehead like fireflies. She had no idea what they were, whether they were chips of naked antimatter, tiny warheads, viral capsules, or miniature gun batteries, except that they intended harm to her creation. "Now," she whispered, "now." She was not disappointed. Perhaps on some level it would have been better if her weapon had been destroyed in that moment, but then she would have been denied the thrill of seeing it react, and react with all the efficacy she had intended. The armaments in the bridgehead's circular rim erupted into life, tracking, lasering, and bowsering each of the glints before many of them had touched the conic weapon's hyperdiamond carapace. The bridgehead accelerated now, covering the final 2 kilometers in a third of a minute, the crust around the wound constantly blistering and releasing glitter, the bridgehead parrying the strikes. There were craters in the weapon's hull now, where a few of the glitter spore had impacted with brief pink radiance, but the bridgehead's operational integrity remained uncompromised. The needle-sharp tip pushed below the level of the crust, accurately positioned in the middle of the wound. Seconds passed, and then the widening haft of the weapon began to brush against its ragged periphery. The ground began to rupture, fracture lines racing away. The blisters were still sprouting, but now at a greater radial distance from the wound, as if the underlying mechanisms were damaged or depleted within that circumference. The bridgehead was now hundreds of meters into Cerberus, shockwaves radiating out from the entry point and hairing up the weapon's length. The piezoelectric crystal buffers, which Volyova had integrated into the hyperdiamond, would damp those shocks, converting their energy into heat, which would then be channeled into the defensive armaments. "Tell me we're winning," Sylvester said. "For God's sake, tell me we're winning." She speed-read the detailed status summaries, spilling onto her bracelet. For a moment there was no antagonism between them, only a shared curiosity. "We're coping," she said. "Weapon is now 1 kilometer in. Maintaining steady descent rate at 1 kilometer every 90 seconds. Thrust level increasing to maximum. That must mean it's encountering mechanical resistance. What is it passing through?" "Can't tell," she said. "Alicia's data said the fake crust was no more than 0.5 kilometer deep. But there are few sensors in the weapon's skin. They would have increased its vulnerability to cybernetic attack modes." What showed on the armillary, relayed from the ship's cameras, was a piece of abstract sculpture, a cone sliced off midway and positioned with its narrowest end resting on a scabrous gray surface. Anguished patterns were playing over the surrounding terrain, blisters spewing spore in random directions, as if their underlying targeting had gone awry. The weapon was slowing now, and though the scene was playing in absolute silence, Volyova could imagine the awful grinding friction, what it would have sounded like had there been air to carry the sound and ears to be deafened by that titanic scraping roar. Now, her bracelet told her, the pressure on the tip had fallen drastically, as if the weapon had finally punctured all the way through the crust and was now probing into the relative hollowness beneath, the domain of the snakes. Slowing. Skull and crossbones symbols danced on her bracelet, signifying the commencement of molecular weapon attack against the bridgehead. Volyova had expected as much. Already, antibodies would be oozing through the carapace, meeting and matching the alien attackers. Slowing, and now stopping. This was as deep as they were going to get, One and one-third of a kilometer of the cone still projected above the cracked surface of Cerberus. What it looked like was some kind of top-heavy cylindrical fortification. The rim armaments were still lancing away at the crustal countermeasures, but now the spore discharges were coming from tens of kilometers away, and it was clear that no immediate threat was posed, unless the crust was capable of improbably rapid regeneration. The bridgehead would now commence anchoring itself, consolidating its gains, analyzing the forms of the molecular weapons being used against it, devising subtly matched reverse strategies. It had not let Volyova down. She pivoted her couch round to face the others, noticing, for the first time in ages, that her fist was still locked around a needle gun.
"We're in," she said.
It looked like a biology lesson for gods, or a snapshot of the kind of pornography which might be enjoyed by sentient planets. In the hours immediately after the weapon's anchoring, Kuri stayed in close consultation with Volyova, reviewing the constantly changing status of the sluggishly fought battle. The geometric forms of the two protagonists reminded her of a conic virus, dwarfed by the much larger spherical cell which it was in the business of corrupting. Yet she had to keep reminding herself that even that insignificant cone was the size of a mountain, that the cell was a world. Nothing very much seemed to be happening now, but that was only because the conflict was being waged primarily on the molecular level, across an invisible, near-fractal front, which extended for tens of square kilometers. At first, and without success, Cerberus had tried to repel the invader with highly entropic weapons, trying to degrade the enemy into megatons of atomic ash. Now its strategy had evolved towards one of digestion. It was still trying to dismantle the enemy atom by atom, but systematically, like a child deconstructing a complex toy, rather than smashing it to pieces, diligently placing each component into its assigned compartment so that it could be used again in the future, in some as-yet undreamt-of project. There was logic to this, after all. A few cubic kilometers of the world had been annihilated by the cache weapons, and Volyova's device presumably consisted of matter in much the same elemental and isotopic ratios as that which had been destroyed. The enemy was a huge potential reservoir of repair material, obviating the need for Cerberus to consume its own finite resources in the process. And perhaps it always sought motherlodes like this, to repair the inevitable damage wrought by millennia of meteorite strikes and the constant ablative toil of cosmic ray bombardment. Perhaps it had seized Sylvest's first probe more because it was hungry than out of a misguided sense that it was preserving its own secrecy, as much acting out of blind stimulus as a Venus flytrap, with no thought for the future. But Volyova's weapon was not designed to be digested without putting up a struggle.
"See, Cerberus is learning from us," she said from her bridge seat,
graphing up schematics of the several dozen different components in the molecular arsenal which the world was now deploying against her weapon. What she was showing looked like a page from an etymology textbook, an array of metallic, differently specialized bugs. Some of them were disassemblers, the front line of the Amarantin defense system. These would physically attack the surface of the bridgehead, dislodging atoms and molecules with their manipulators, tugging apart chemical bonds. They would also engage in hand-to-hand combat with Volyova's own frontline forces. What matter they succeeded in wresting free, they passed back to fatter bugs, behind the immediate battlefront. Like tireless clerks, these units endlessly categorized and sorted the chunks of matter they received. If it was structurally simple, like a single undifferentiated chunk of iron or carbon, they tagged it for recycling and passed it to other, even fatter factory bugs, which were manufacturing more bugs according to their internal templates. And if the chunks of matter had been organized so that within them was true structure, they were not passed for immediate recycling, but were instead passed to other bugs which dismantled the chunks and tried to figure out if they embodied any useful principles. If so, the principles would be learnt, tailored, and passed to the factory bugs. That way the next generation of bugs would be fractionally more advanced than the last.
"Learning from us,"
Volyova said again, as if she found the prospect as glorious as it was disturbing.
"Unpicking our countermeasures,
and incorporating their design philosophies into its own forces. You don't have to sound so cheerful about it. Curry was eating a ship-grown apple. But why not? It's an elegant system. I can learn from it, of course. But it isn't the same thing. What's happening down there is methodical, endless, and there isn't the tiniest grain of sentience behind any of it. She said it with genuine awe.
Yes, very impressive, Curry said.
Blind replication. Nothing smart about it. But because it's happening simultaneously in a billion-odd places, they win over us by sheer weight of numbers. Isn't that what's going to happen? You're going to sit here and think like hell, and it won't make a bit of difference to the outcome. Sooner or later they'll learn every trick you have. But not just yet. Volyova cocked her head towards the schematic. You think I'd have been stupid enough to hit them with the most advanced countermeasures we have? You never do that in war, Curry. You never expend any more energy or intelligence against an enemy than is absolutely appropriate to the situation at hand, just as you never play your best card first in a poker game. You wait until the stakes justify it. And then she explained how the current countermeasures being deployed by her weapons were really very old, and not especially sophisticated. She had adapted them from ancient entries in the holographically distributed database of the Warchive, about 300 years behind the current day, she said.
But Cerberus is catching up.
Correct. But that rate of technical gain is actually rather stable, probably because of the thoughtless way in which our secrets are being used. There are no intuitive jumps possible, so the Amarantine systems evolve linearly. It's like someone trying to crack a code by sheer brute force computation, and because of that, I know rather precisely how long it will take for them to overtake our current level. At the moment they're catching up by about a decade for every 3 or 4 hours of ship time, which gives us slightly less than a week before things get interesting.
And this isn't?
Curry shook her head, feeling, not for the first time, that there were many things she did not understand about Volyova.
Just how do these escalations take place?
Does your weapon carry a copy of the Warchive?
No. Too dangerous.
Right. It'd be like sending a soldier behind enemy lines with every secret you've got.
How do you do it?
Transmit the secrets down to the weapon only when they're needed?
Isn't that just as risky?
That's how it happens. But it's much safer than you think. The transmissions are encrypted using a one-time PED, a randomly generated string of digits which specifies the change to be made to each bit in the raw signal. Whether you add a 0 or a 1 to it, after you've encrypted the signal with the PED, there's no way the enemy can recover the meaning without their own copy of the PED. The weapon needs one, of course, but the copy it carries is stored deep inside, beyond tens of meters of solid diamond, with hyper-secure optical links to the assembler control systems. Only if the weapon were under major attack would there be any risk of the PED being captured, and in that case, I'd simply refrain from transmitting anything.
Curry finished the apple down to the seedless core.
So there is a way, she said, after thinking for a moment.
A way to what?
To end all this.
We want to do that, don't we?
You don't think the damage has already been done?
We can't know for sure, but supposing it hasn't. After all, what we've seen so far is just a layer of camouflage. And below that a layer of defenses designed to protect the camouflage.
It's amazing, yes, and the mere fact that it's an alien technology means we could probably learn from it. But we still don't know what it's hiding.
She thumped her chair in emphasis, gratified to see Volyova react with a small shiver.
It's something we haven't reached yet, haven't even glimpsed, and we won't until Sylvester actually goes down there.
We'll stop him from leaving.
Volyova patted the needler, which was tucked into her belt.
We control things now.
And take the risk that he'll kill us all by triggering the thing in his eyes?
Pascal said it was a bluff.
Yeah, and I'm sure she believes it.
Curry didn't need to say any more. It was obvious from the slow way she nodded that Volyova understood.
There's a better way, she continued. Let Sylvester leave if he wants.
but will make damn sure he doesn't have an easy time getting inside. By which you'll mean, I'll say it even if you won't. We have to let it die, Volyova. We have to let Cerberus win.